Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Dave Wegner and dedicated to all the scientists and river community who have worked to protect the Colorado River, Grand Canyon, and its environment. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures.
Hey, this is a big welcome to everybody. This is Brian Durker and Wayne Rainey.
Rani.
Rhymes with granny.
I've done that before with you, too. It's Wayne Rainey. And what a great way to start, correcting my pronunciation of your name. Now, I like to start these things with where were you born? Let's start right from the first moment of Wayne Rainey.
Well, surprising to a lot of people, I'm a Southern California boy.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Well, that even surprises me.
Exactly. It always does now. And when I first moved to Flagstaff back in the 70s, people would say to me, you don't seem like you're from California. And I never knew what to make of that. Maybe my hair wasn't blonde or something.
It's the greatest compliment you'll ever get.
No, right.
Just kidding, you Southern California listeners.
So I grew up in the shadow of Mount Baldy in the eastern part of L.A. County. There were orange groves that were being rapidly developed into subdivisions. But me and my two brothers, we were all over the place collecting frogs, collecting snakes, feeding the frogs to the snakes. And at a very early age, you know, like all kids were in those days, we just played outside.
Yeah.
And never came home unless it was dinner time.
Well, and that was the same childhood I had, you know.
Yep.
It was like six kids. She'd kick us out the door and
yep.
come back for lunch and come back for dinner. So your family lived down there, brothers and sisters? Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have two brothers and one sister, and they all still live in Southern California. My father, Don Rainey, is still alive.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly enough, he was a surveyor for the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California.
Oh, wow. That's a story all its own right there.
And he would go out to the Mojave Desert, and he would bring home fossils. And I remember as a 10-year-old kid, my dad showed me these fossils from the Mojave Desert of seashells.
Right.
And that really struck me. Now, my two brothers, they looked at it and said, oh, that's nice. But for me, that sparked something, the fact that there were fossils in the desert. We would drive one way to go to Newport Beach, and we drove the other way to go to the desert, and he found these sea fossils right there in the desert. I think it always stuck with me.
Yeah, no, that's those early impressions really can be the switch, can't they?
And here's another Southern California story. We used to go to Disneyland. I had a friend whose father said, I'll drive you to Disneyland every weekend if you guys pay to go in. One summer, we went to Disneyland every weekend. And one of those trips, we drove or rode on the train that goes around the park. And those of you that have ridden the train, there's a tunnel at the end where you go through a diorama of the primeval world with dinosaurs and the Grand Canyon.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, as a 13-year-old boy, we were sitting on the train, and there's a mountain lion in a ponderosa pine, and you see the diorama of the Grand Canyon. And it must have had an effect on me because my life has been ruined by the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, another young life ruined, right? I've always said that. You know, that's a great one. I haven't ever gotten that. You know, everybody has different initial exposures to the place.
Yeah.
The ride through the Disneyland park, that's a great early. They must have done a good job with that ride.
Well, it was Disney. Of course they did a good job. There's no limitations with money or anything.
Yeah. No, that is very
strange connection, huh? Disneyland and the Grand Canyon, and it did have an effect.
Well, and quite often, I'm afraid, sometimes people assume it is Disneyland when you get them down there until they cut their foot or fall in the river or this, that, or the other. You were in Southern Cal through high school and through your early years of schooling?
Yep, I went to a Catholic boys' high school, and I ran track. I was very fast. One time I ran a 9.9 100-yard
dash.
It was wind-aided, I have to put that at the end.
But a little wind.
It was a breeze. But I have run some 10 flats, but that was a long time ago.
No, that is fast.
Yeah,
that
it was.
Fast. Track was always, I got more nervous before a race in track than I even did ski racing.
I love that feeling, Brian. That nervousness before you get down in the blocks and you look at your hands and the gun's going to go. Yeah.
I loved track too. It was great. I was a 440 guy.
And
220 at times.
The longest sprint.
Oh, that was a miserable race by the end of it.
Well, you have the legs for it. Yep. They wanted me to do the 440, and I said, I'm not running that far.
It was a mean one. I think the meanest race, though, is the 800 meter now, and it's the 400 meter. But back then, it was the 880, half mile. I never understood those people.
I still have close friends from high school, and we will always have the record for the 440 relay.
Oh, good.
Because now it's the 400 meter relay, and there is no breaking of the record.
Isn't it great getting old like this? It's great.
It really is.
Your high school years were good. Did you guys win state, or did you do well in the state as far as competing against the other schools?
Yeah, we had a really great track team, and I'm still really good friends with high school buddies. We get together once a year, and you know, you go to a Catholic boys' high school, you have to put up with a lot of shit from the public school kids, and it kind of bonded us, you know, and we're still really good friends, and my 50th reunion is next year, so... Looking forward to that.
Oh, 50th year reunion. My goodness gracious. Yeah. So you graduated...
72. Yeah.
A couple years before I did.
I think you're 73 or 74.
I'm 74,
74.
And so then you got straight A's probably in high school. You were an excellent student.
I went to college right out of high school, and I got C's and D's and put on probation. And that was at Cal Poly Pomona.
Oh, wow. Cal Poly. Yeah.
And after 2 years, I just said, this isn't working for me. You know, I was put on probation and I quit. My mother got me a job with some people they square danced with, and they got me a job with the California Division of Forestry. And I worked on a crew called the Ecology Crew. It was a group set up in California for conscientious objectors of the Vietnam War. But after the war was over, they just let young kids like me join it. So I lived in Bishop, California, almost got on with the Mammoth Hotshots. And then one of these high school buddies that I'm still friends with, we did a 2-week trip to the Southwest, and we did a 4-day backpack in Bryce, an overnight backpack in Zion, and a cross canyon backpack through the Grand Canyon. And I'll never forget it. It was September of 1975.
That changed everything, yeah.
Literally, we were at the Babbitt store sitting on the picnic bench figuring out the expenses. Everybody got up from the picnic bench except for me, and they said, come on, Wayne, we're going back. And I said, I'm going to stay and look for a job.
Really?
Yes. And I stayed there on that picnic bench, and the following day was a Sunday. I sat on the porch of the El Tovar and read John Wesley Powell's book. And then Monday morning, I marched over to the visitor center, which is now the park headquarters building.
Right.
And I started asking about a job, and by 11 o'clock that morning, they had offered me a volunteer position for the Park Service at Phantom Ranch.
Oh, no kidding.
And I have been...
What year was that? It was...
1975.
Yeah, there you go.
And the guy handed me a radio and a ranger shirt, and he said, okay, get on the trail. And I said, I got to go back to California and quit my job and get my clothing. So I took a week and then came back, and I've been back. I've been in Northern Arizona ever since 1975.
That is a Grand Canyon story right there.
And the first place I lived in Arizona was Phantom Ranch.
Well, and that in its own right is a big adventure of life, you know. Yes. I love those stories. I absolutely love
those
that.
Those were the times, weren't they?
Yeah,
I mean, we were all young.
It was
young.
A different age. It was wide open.
I didn't have to be anywhere or go anywhere. I was responsible enough to go back and quit my job in California as a firefighter.
Well, as a firefighter?
Yeah, I was with the Ecology Corps.
Corps.
You know, just a bunch of young kids. And, that's kind of how I got exposed to the Grand Canyon, because I did that for 3 seasons with the Park Service. But what got me into the river thing was that during my first winter there, Steve Carruthers was doing research trips with the Museum of Northern Arizona.
Exactly, yeah.
George Ruffner was part of that crew,
Ruffner,
if you remember George.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very well.
And they'd pull into the beach at Phantom Ranch, and I was the young ranger, you know, gangly 21-year-old kid. And Phil Hecker, who was the main ranger, he'd say, come on, we got to meet a river trip down there. And he'd have me with the wheelbarrow, and They had car batteries for something. They needed car batteries to charge some stuff, but they'd always come in really cold in December and January, back when it used to be cold. And I'd invite them to the ranger station and make them hot chocolate. And one time Steve says to me, "Why don't you come down the river with us?" Steve was like only 10 years out of his PhD, I think.
Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, that at that time. Yeah.
But he was gung-ho with these river trips. And my very first river trip, I only went from Phantom to Hermit. But that night, we camped on the granite beach, and it was March of 76. And he had buried a load of human waste on the granite beach. And he went back in March and put a probe in the ground to see if the E. coli was still viable after a winter sitting in the sand.
Ever the scientist, Dr. Steve Kravitz. Ever the scientist.
And this was all the invention of the Groover.
Yeah.
Because people were burying their waste in these beaches. And once he found out that the E. coli could survive over a winter, then this idea for the Groover started. And I can't believe that my first trip was involved some way with that.
Well, and he sent me some articles and some we touched on that in when he was on the show here, and it's always been a real proud thing that he's done for the canyon and you've done for the canyon.
No, I didn't do anything. I was just a young kid, just going, "What's going
on?" It was a really it was a big game changer.
It really was, and you know, at the time, I had no idea what it was all about, but. You know, Groovers are used all over the rivers of the world.
Now. Well, and for the listener, and we've touched on this with other shows, but we haul the human waste out now. But there was a long progression of how do you handle human waste in a pristine environment like Grand Canyon. And it was a long process to figure out what the actual impacts were and how to fix those impacts. And these guys were really... leading edge as far as how to take care of the place.
It was such an odd thing that on one of my first commercial river trips with Wilderness World, apparently there was a woman on that trip who did not take a dump for the whole 14 days.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's even humanly possible, but it was said amongst the crew.
She was fairly grumpy by the takeout. Well, and it was also Wilderness World that dubbed the name Groover.
Oh, is that right?
Interesting story. They had forgotten or lost the toilet seat that used to sit down on these 20-millimeter military ammunition cans that we use still prolifically in the river trips because they're a nice metal box that's sealable and has a real good airtight seal. They lost that ring that they set on this thing. And so instead of saying, "Hey, we screwed up and forgot the toilet ring," they just told people, "Yeah, that's how we do it. We just sit on the can." And so people in the morning would be drinking their coffee and walking around, and they had these grooves down the backs of their legs from sitting on the sharp edges of this ammo can. And that's where the name Groover came from these portable toilets. And one other thing, through that process, with the toilets and all that, we used to bury them, and what Wayne's talking about is we used to bury them in the deep, endless sand beaches. We'd just dig a deep hole and drop the content with enzyme, this blue goo stuff.
And bacon grease.
And bacon grease and everything else. And we realized soon, especially during the process of losing all those sediments, that you'd see these blue streaks coming out of the sandbank. And we realized soon that was not a viable way. And like Steve, checking for long-term stability of poo in the sand.
And the other thing is, in 1976, everybody's getting used to a dam-controlled river.
Yeah.
They had only closed the gates 11 years before.
Yeah, 10 years, 11 years.
You know, I mean, it was a brand new ball game down there.
And, you know, for the listener, again, sand has always been slowly but surely being depleted from the system because the dam stops all these massive loads of material from going through to the Grand Canyon. You know, most of the Colorado Plateau, the river runs through these sedimentary layers that pick up all this sand. And in the past, you'd have these high flows that would scour everything down there. And then as it dropped, it would leave behind this massive amount of sand. Where you put the dam there, you don't have the high flows anymore, fluctuating flows. Slowly but surely, that sand has been broken down into the bottom of the river and eventually washed downriver. So,
into the Lake Mead formation.
Into the Lake Mead formation, right. And we'll let Wayne talk to us a little bit about that. The Steve Carruthers connection comes up quite a bit.
Yeah.
With a lot of people, he's influenced a lot of people down here, and he's a remarkable influence.
My first three river trips in Grand Canyon were with Steve.
So let's real quick talk about a couple things that you and I were both there for in our careers, and then we'll get back to the guiding and this, that, and the other. But I think both of us saw the 77 low water.
Yep.
And we both were there for the 83 high flows. And that's a difference between 1,000 cubic feet per second clear up to almost 100,000 cubic feet per second. So that's a big scale. One thing I remember about the 77 low flows is just how difficult it was. It was really rocky. I luckily was in a kayak on a trip. Marv Jensen gave me a permit to bring a bunch of guides down there and figure out if there's a commercial viability of guiding at those low flows. And so it was a kind of a wild trip. I invited all my buddies, and it was quite a group.
I did a trip in March of 77 with Steve Carruthers and Bobby Jensen and Norm Sharber was
right.
A good friend of Steve's at that time. We got to Lava Falls at 1,000 CFS, and I'm not making this up, but Steve Martin was also on that trip because he was the Park Service River Ranger at that time, long before his superintendent days. We stopped at Lava. They felt like they couldn't run it at 1,000 CFS, and Steve hiked up the Lava Falls Trail to go to John Riffey's place, under the presumption they were going to call Glen Canyon Dam to let out more water.
They were heady, weren't they?
Oh, my God. And they literally were gone all night, and they came back the next morning. And the reason I'm thinking to myself this really happened is because I doubt it. I mean, like, they would have known better. You can't call up Glen Canyon Dam and instantly order more water, let alone that it's going to get down there almost 200 miles
from
the dam.
Both of those men had a certain amount of swagger back
then.
Oh,
my God. I think they were just, you know, alpha mailing each other going up the
trail. You can count on that. A lot of testosterone in those days.
So I was with the trip with Norm Henderson. He was a resource manager.
I remember Norm, yeah.
We wanted to row across, and just before they hiked out the trail, I asked Steve Carruthers, I said, we're going to take your boat across the river and go look on the other side. And Steve looked at us and he says, okay, well, don't you guys get drunk and ruin my boat. And I replied to him, we won't ruin your boat.
And so how did that resolve? Because
they came back the next morning
and you
we
guys
just
ran
around.
And they were beat.
I guess they were, you know. Yeah. I'm still green behind the ears. I don't know what's going on. Everything's just happening, and I'm loving the shit out of it.
Well, I remember real vividly, basically the rapid was over by the V waves. I mean, that leading edge of the rapid was just a really steep, free-fally sort of deal. And you were out of the rapid, well out of the rapid by the time you got to the Black Rock down there.
Yeah.
It was pretty wild. But then the other end of the spectrum is, of course, that 83 high flow. And for the listener, it took 20 years to fill Glen Canyon Dam or fill Lake Powell, the reservoir behind Glen Canyon Dam. And lo and behold, that's 1983. They didn't forecast the inflow, and they had a full lake. Long story short, they had a crisis there and had to open up the spillways. And then there was a degrade on the left spillway, and it was absolutely wild how the thing went, because the lake kept coming up and up and up, and they kept dumping more and more water out. So, lo and behold, in 1983, they We almost had historic average high flows, pre-dam flows, almost 100,000. And it was quite something. Some of us that were lucky enough to get on the river, they did a moratorium.
Yep.
And actually, I was on a McCallum trip, and we were the last trip to leave because when we were getting ready to leave, the ranger came down and told McCallum that we couldn't go. And he had all his paying passengers sitting on the boat. We were getting ready to leave. And McCallum put his arm around the ranger and said, "Let's talk." And he was walking him up the ramp. And then he turned around to me and waved for me to take off. So I went, "Okay." Off we went. And so I know we were the last trip, but it was really an amazing, life-changing experience. And you're a geologist. I think the biggest thing I got out of it was standing at Crystal, which was it's a big rapid down there that had flooded, what was it, in 68?
66.
And a huge amount of water came out of there and shoved all this debris out into the channel. And so all of a sudden we had this gigantic new rapid in Grand Canyon. And it's of legendary proportion, how it changed that. It was just a small riffle. I have friends that ran before and after that flood. Long story short, though, when it came up, it was the first time that debris fan had seen historic flows.
Yep.
So when you're standing on the shore scouting Crystal, it had this incredible constriction, which created one of the biggest holes that the rapid has ever seen.
It's called a hydraulic jump.
And yep. Sue Kiefer did some great studies on that. She is a volcanologist or a nozzles expert that came in and did some amazing studies. And what she found about Crystal, too, was that it had the most radical closure. It had the steepest constriction of any debris fan that we have down there. And that's probably its youthfulness and post-damness. But what it really amazed me, Wayne, was you could hear those rocks moving, big rocks. And I actually ran it. I was one of the first boats with a large group of people at the rapid. I went out there and ran it first, and I hit an unseen rock. I mean, all of us were pulling so far right, you could get vegetation in your teeth because you didn't want to get anywhere near this hole.
Yeah, we did the Tammy run on our trip.
Yeah, everybody did.
Yep.
And we walked people for 2 years around Crystal because of this hole. I hit a rock, and it actually rolled under the boat.
Oh.
And the boat rolled off the back of it.
Oh, my gosh.
It was crazy. And I've got, actually, Dick Behan took some photographs, and I've got some photographs of the boat just getting thrown vertically up. But it was a remarkable experience, and you realize how dormant the flows that we have are in regards to the cutting power and material moving.
Right.
It made me realize why the Grand Canyon was there. It was all from high flow to high flow to high flow. And the rest of the time, it was kind of a sleepy, lazy old creek.
Well, my story actually revolves around the moratorium you mentioned.
Uh-huh.
Because the Park Service tried to shut down the river, but really couldn't. And a group of us here in Flagstaff got a canceled private permit on June 30th. And we assembled a trip on July 1st. And we drove up to Lee's Ferry, and we put on at about 2 in the afternoon on July 2nd, and we took out at Diamond Creek in an oar-powered trip on July 5th. We were on the water for 70 hours with oar boats.
Was that the trip with Kyle Kovalek and stuff?
No, this was not with Kyle.
That was a different one.
This was Larry Stevens was the de facto trip leader. Gary Kuchel, an old Azra guide, rowed a boat. I rowed a boat, and George Marsick started out rowing a boat, but he injured his back in one of the rapids, and we had to have some of our guests take the boat down through. But 70 hours from Lee's Ferry to Diamond
Creek.
Amazing. And we were not trying to set a speed record. The whole thing was just to see what the river was like. And just a couple notable things.
Wow.
I must have
gotten a trip. Now, that's a big adventure.
I was still kind of learning the river, so I didn't know it as well as I do now, but I was literally a half a mile below House Rock Rapid before I looked upstream and said that was House Rock.
You didn't even know it was there.
It was
flat
water.
Wayne, another thing I remember about it, I was the trip leader of a five-boat trip. And so I would pull into an eddy, lucky to get there because the eddy fences were so huge
and it was hydraulic.
And we'd be lucky to get all five boats in. So then somebody'd miss it and we'd all have to pull back out there. But what I remember, you're all sitting in the eddy and, okay, we're going to go downstream. You'd pull out downstream. Downstream you'd go, and you'd be a quarter of a mile downstream from the second boat coming out. It was like a flume. It was amazing.
And the middle Granite Gorge was the worst there. That Granite Narrows for the kayakers that were on our trip. You just get thrown into the wall.
Into the wall, the whole. And, you know, you're a geologist, and I don't know if my interpretive
story. Man. You're fine.
I don't know if it's okay with this huge Surprise Valley slump. In 83, you could feel how juvenile that gorge was.
And it is juvenile. It's because of that big slump. That's a new channel.
It's a new channel. The river got moved over. And for the listener, there was this probably cubic mile of the north rim slumped.
Just let loose.
And it was a single time event, right?
Well, there's multiple landslides in this. And there's subsets off of the big landslide.
But
suffice it to say, the old river channel was filled and the river found a new course through bedrock to the south of that. And that's the Granite Narrows.
That's the Granite Narrows. And you could really sense how juvenile, the way the water was. It was like nowhere else on the river was that weird. It just rolled over to the right shore.
We camped three nights on that trip. The first camp was 24 and a half at the McDonald inscription. The second camp was 94 mile within earshot of Hermit. And the last camp was up in the mouth of National.
Yeah.
24 and a half, 94 mile.
That's
an
amazing trip you were on there. That's way cool.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So that's a neat thing. We've both been here for so long, we've shared some of those experiences, which I'm
You were on one of my first commercial trips.
Uh-huh.
I was on a WeWo trip rowing a baggage boat, and you talked your way on to just bringing your kayak and just following along on the trip.
Yeah, I remember that trip.
And I distinctly remember you stopping above Serpentine Rapid on the right and peering into that big hole, because 1980 was another big water year.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And, you know, it was running 30,000 in 1980.
And that Serpentine hole was a savage hole.
I think you were thinking about it, because I distinctly remember as a young boatman looking at you, and you were checking that thing out.
I ended up going right of it.
Oh, you did?
Very narrow opportunity of failure there.
Yeah.
But I remember that trip. That's great.
Yeah.
Wilderness World, that was a neat company.
I just visited with Kyle last week. He came through town.
Yeah, he stopped by here. His father, Vladimir Kovalik, was an amazing guy.
Yeah.
He escaped from the war, his story was remarkable.
What an adventurer.
And here's to him. Unfortunately, this last year we lost him. So.
Yeah.
Here's to him. We got a lot to talk about. You know, the WeWo trips, let's talk a little bit about the lower end, because you spent a lot of time down there doing your geology and with Steve Glass.
I remember seeing
you down there with Steve Glass.
I was trying to break into the river business, and, you know, I figured, I rode two baggage boat trips with WeWo, and I went to Gary Casey, the lead guide, and I said, I'd like to do four trips next year. And he laughed at me, you know, I mean, they only had one crew, and it was pretty tight crew.
Pretty tight crew.
So Howie Usher got me some work down there with Stevie Glass in the Lower Gorge. We used to do four-day trips from Diamond Creek to Pierce Ferry, and we would go every weekend, Thursday to Sunday.
I remember seeing you guys
Stevie
down there.
Stevie Glass had all kinds of clientele. He had the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, the UCLA Alumni Association.
He had a lot going on.
Roger Henderson worked those trips, Joe Sharber, Glenn Rink.
Yeah, we all had, those guys. We you had guys fun. Had a great crew.
It was unbelievable. It's just fantastic down there. And when on a four-day trip, you have the opportunity to really explore. Our first camp was 4 miles downstream at Travertine.
No, it's a true gem. And for the listener, when we talk about the lower end, that means you put in at Diamond Creek, which is the takeout of a lot of trips from the upper end. But there's this lower gorge, this granite gorge down there, the lower granite gorge, and it is a remarkable feature. Throughout the whole canyon, it's got these polished, fluted sculptures ground into the rocks on shoreline, and it's got some feisty little rapids that go through there. And then, unfortunately, it dies into the head up. The top water of Lake Mead, but it's a remarkable trip down there.
Well, those four-day trips were really special, and we'd camp at Bridge City the second night. Then we'd pull in on the third day to Spencer, and we'd have an early dinner. And then on the last night of the trip, we'd tie up all the boats together and do a night float.
And back then, you could go to sleep and just see where you woke up the next
morning. We never knew where we were going to wake up. If we were asleep and we got into an eddy, we'd have quite a bit to motor on that last bit of Lake Mead. But a lot of times we'd make it downstream. But maybe on an X-rated version of your podcast, we can talk about some of the adventures we had down there on the night float.
Oh, my God. I'm looking forward to my X series. I'll have a lot of the same guests that it seemed to hold themselves back on the early shows.
Well, you know, there is an interesting thought out there about these stories, and they're not necessarily bad stories. You know, you say X-rated and all of that, but really, it was a part of history. There was a moment in time down there where it was just a different way of life, and it was the way that people moved through life. Nobody got hurt. Nobody was disrespected. Everybody was open to it. And
it was a free land.
And, it was.
It was occasionally lawless.
Yes, occasionally
but
lawless.
Generally kind. Yeah. And I agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more.
So I did the lower gorge thing, and then George Marsick moved in and rented a room at a house that I owned on North San Francisco, 711 North San Francisco. And he came to me one day and he says, "Wayne, I'm starting a river company." And that was the start of worldwide explorations.
Right.
And George got a commercial running permit for the San Juan, the Salt, the Verde, and the Dolores. And I was with George at the moment that company was born, and I was one of his main guides, along with a host of other people
will interview. Days, yeah.
And I did more than 100 trips on the San Juan and many trips on the Salt.
Is that right? That's a bunch. And what great geology and archaeology, and it's really a cool place.
It really is a nice run. It just lacks the big rapids. You know, the San Juan does not have the big rapids, but
It's definitely a fantasy island sort of trip. It's really cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you like it. A lot of Grand Canyon boatmen think, that's nice, but I'm not going to do it.
Oh, no. You know, actually, McCallum, we do a couple trips up there a year.
Nice.
In the early spring.
Okay.
And before our schedule got going in the Grand Canyon. So
that was interesting because those were the days before Quartzsite was blown up. And when we got to Quartzsite, we had to de-rig and portage our rafts around Quartzsite.
Yeah,
that'd be half a day. You know, we'd have a 5-boat trip and everything with us, and that's not an easy portage.
No, Quartzsite, we're on the Salt now.
Yeah.
And but Quartzsite was a piece of work, wasn't it? I remember the first time I kayaked Quartzsite, and I didn't do very well doing that.
Well, at least you survived.
I survived. Now let's talk a little bit about your guiding. I'm excited to hear about, number one, just the M&A stuff, but also the we'll move into some of your global trot there.
Oh, yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about your trail guiding.
Well, 1982, I was an assistant to Lex Lindsay, who was a rather famous archaeologist with the Museum of Northern Arizona. He was on the Glen Canyon project where they salvaged the stuff that was going to be inundated by the filling of Lake Powell. He did a trip every year to Keat Seal Ruin, and I got hired to be his assistant.
Oh, wow.
And just one day on the trail, maybe my third time going back there with him, I said, hey, Lex, do you mind if I say something about the geology? And Lex was a rather formal guy. You know, he had little index cards in his top pocket. And when we would sit down to take a break hiking into Keetseal, he'd say, well, we're 15 minutes slower than 5 years ago, but we are 20 minutes ahead from 8 years ago. And of course, I wasn't a guide like that at all. So I asked Lex, and he was a little hesitant to have somebody else talk on his trip. But I kind of think that moment in 1982 is when I really felt that I could be a guide. And so I started being a trail guide with the museum. It led hundreds of backpacks across the Grand Canyon and up in Grand Staircase, Escalante, and all over the place. I love being a trail guide.
Yeah, no,
and it kind of, you know, fit in with being a river guide and things like that. You kind of go through a thing where when you first get on the river, you think this is the best thing in the world. You can bring your little Walkman and listen to music, if you remember Walkmans.
Oh, yeah.
Playing the cassettes out there. But then I kind of went back on it and I said, well, I don't want to bring too much stuff. So I got into trail guiding for a while and I really, really loved it. I've had to give it up now because I have two artificial knees, but many, many decades being a trail guide.
And is why you have artificial knees.
Is why, exactly. Hundreds of backpacks in the Grand Canyon will do that.
It's a mean, mean sport there, that one.
And then Stuart Aitchison kind of got me into some international guiding with a company that was then known as Special Expeditions, but it was Sven Olof Lindblad, who now runs Lindblad Expeditions.
Which is big.
It's a huge company. Yeah. They're on the New York Stock Exchange now, but this was the early days when it was just starting out, and we got to go to Baja California on very small ships. And our job was to drive Zodiacs. So we'd lower the Zodiacs off the top deck and we'd drive people ashore. And then when we weren't doing that, you know, those of us that were qualified would give lectures, and I'd give lectures about geology or earth science or something like that.
Okay, now that was a good job.
And I did that. I'm still doing it, actually. I'm still doing those trips, but that started in 1988, and I've been to over 90 countries. I would just go everywhere they went.
Really, 90 countries?
Yeah.
Man. How cool is that?
And I mean, driving.
Can I go with you?
You
as
can
your
go,
assistant?
But usually people fit in the suitcase, and you're not going to fit in the suitcase, so we're going to have to come up with another.
A cello case, maybe.
Okay, let's put you in a cello case. Some of the interesting things we did, one time I got on the ship for 4 months in a row, and we started in Lisbon, Portugal, sailed all the way up the Mediterranean to Turkey. Then we turned around and made different stops out of the Mediterranean. And while crossing the Atlantic to go to the Amazon River, the captain stopped the ship right in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and he said, anybody that wants to go swimming in 15,000 feet of water, we're going to lower the gangway. And it was unbelievable.
I bet you could feel it.
Well, you know, if you're a Grand Canyon River guide, you're not afraid of anything. So my bathing suit was already on. As soon as I got in the water, you're exactly right. You felt 15,000 feet of water.
Oh, that's
and I
unreal.
Stayed within a really safe distance of that gangway. And, you know, it's just like jumping in the pool.
Or floating around it, like if you were spacewalking or something, right?
It was really something. And then at the end of that, we sailed 1,000 miles up the Amazon and 1,000 miles back. And I think I got off the ship in Trinidad and Tobago and made my way back home.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the stories driving these Zodiacs, you know, 29 times to Antarctica and all these places, it was just another way to be a guide. And so my Grand Canyon guiding actually is what sort of facilitated.
Kind of launched some great stuff.
Exactly.
But that's remarkable. That tell us a little bit about your poles, you know, those polar expeditions and stuff. Tell us a little bit about that, Wayne.
So, you know, when the ship expedition thing started going, they would go to places like Baja and Alaska, and these places started to be a little bit front country. So the industry has really migrated towards polar exploration, both the Arctic and the Antarctic. And so we have done quite a few cruises very far north and very far south. And there's an archipelago called Svalbard or Spitsbergen up in the northern part of Norway.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God, those islands are unbelievably fantastic with all kinds of wildlife, great geology, great glaciology, wonderful history of polar exploration. And when I was in graduate school studying geology at Northern Arizona University, I had an opportunity to go work for the United States Antarctic Research Program. And I took a year off from graduate school, and then I worked at McMurdo and South Pole stations.
Oh, wow.
And I got to live at the South Pole, and we happened to be there during the 75th anniversary of Roald Amundsen's first arrival. I can see on your bookcase over here some Antarctic exploration books.
No, I love that stuff. It's fantastic.
I got way deep into the Antarctic for a while. And living at the South Pole was one of the most interesting things I've ever experienced, just how you go about living at the South Pole. And every time the plane comes in to bring people, they offload their extra fuel into these fuel bladders, and there's a whole wing of the station. This is in the old days when they had the dome. They offload these fuel bladders because the last plane leaves in February and the next one didn't come back till October. They had to have enough fuel to run those diesel engines to keep things warm over the Antarctic winter.
Wow.
Real isolation. Just,
and how many people would be down there?
17 people in those days would typically overwinter, and they would, of course, have one medical doctor, but they had two diesel mechanics. That's how important they figured that was.
Hopefully they had a cook, too.
Oh, yeah. Nobody starves in the Antarctic anymore.
Well, and you can always go get yourself a seal or something, couldn't you?
Well, the South Pole is on the polar plateau at 9,000 feet.
Yeah, there's no seal.
There's nothing there. I remember all the time I worked at the South Pole, one day a seagull flew over. And everybody got excited because it had obviously been blown off course.
It was a living thing.
There was nothing that lives on the polar plateau.
What kind of geology is it down there?
Antarctica is a continent just like any other continent. And just because 98% of it is covered in ice doesn't mean it doesn't have geology.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's got fantastic geology.
Is it sedimentaries?
Yeah, the Transantarctic Mountains have a lot of sedimentary rock. And they were uplifted with the collision between the East Antarctic with the West Antarctic.
Plates.
So the Transantarctic Mountains are about 2,500 miles long, and they go up to as high as 14,000 feet.
Oh, I didn't realize they went up to that high of an elevation.
And, of course, glaciers pouring out of them, but wherever you have the sheer cliffs, it's all rock exposures. And the Museum of Northern Arizona sent Bill Breed down there in 1968. They actually found the fossils of an amphibian called Lystrosaurus. And finding that fossil in Antarctica was the final piece of the puzzle for continental drift. Because Lystrosaurus had been found in India and Australia. But they figured if they could find it in Antarctica, that would prove that Antarctica was once connected to the other continents. And Bill Breed and Ned Colbert found that fossil in 1968.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
There is a Flagstaff connection to the acceptance of plate tectonics.
Bill Breed was a remarkable fellow.
He kind of was my mentor to be a geologist because one of my early Grand Canyon River trips, he was the geologist on the trip. And he kind of took me under his wing and...
Really cool dude.
He ended up hiring me to be a work-study student when I was at NAU, and I had a job at the museum studying geology. So, you know, you live at the bottom of the Grand Canyon for 3 years as a ranger. You work as a river guide and a trail guide in the Grand Canyon. You know, the geology is going to click for you.
Oh, and if it doesn't, shame on you.
It did in a big way for me.
Back to Bill Breed. He was my mother's bridge partner.
Oh, you're kidding.
In the day. So that's how all of us got to know him.
And wow.
He and my mother were close friends.
He was a big personality in Flagstaff.
And he certainly was.
Thank goodness for Bill Breed.
Yeah, I could not agree more.
Thank you.
The beat goes on, but let's talk a little bit about your... you've been on some neat film projects, some documentaries. And
yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, a lot of that is the result of my book, Carving Grand Canyon. In 2005, I wrote a book called Carving Grand Canyon.
Yep.
And that's an interesting story we could talk about how that book came. But when that book came out, kind of gave me some cred. And the phone started ringing from a lot of these documentaries about the Grand Canyon or other things. And I started being a voice and a presence in front of the camera, just doing little sound bites, as it turns out, but little things about the geology of the Grand Canyon, geology of the Southwest. One of the more interesting ones was this National Geographic thing that we did. And we flew by helicopter from Grand Canyon to Moab. We had to stop in Page to refuel. This was in November. And when we got to the Moab airport, they took the door off the helicopter. And the chute was to go around the priest and the nun in Professor Valley. I was going to talk about erosion while we're sitting in the helicopter. So we're in the helicopter and we're flying very, very cold November day. We're just freezing up there. And we take off from Moab and we fly towards the Professor Valley. And this guy with this huge camera is right next to me, filming me as the helicopter pilot is circling around the two buttes. And I just thought to myself, if this camera guy accidentally hits my seatbelt and I go flying out, that's not going to be part of the show.
Great footage.
So I had my hand on the seatbelt right there while we're flying around the priest and the nun doing this thing.
How cool is that?
Yeah, it was, oh my God, I got some of the best pictures flying between Grand Canyon and Moab. It was a crystal clear day.
I need a copy of that book too, oh, by the way.
Okay. We'll get you one.
Yeah, there you go. And so what other stuff have you done is for, in regards to production stuff? I know you've Discovery Channel, I think I remember something.
Yeah, and then there was the local PBS channel out of Phoenix.
Yeah.
We did a thing called Under Arizona, and I went into the Lava River Cave here near Flagstaff with them.
Cool.
And the History Channel, and did some stuff on Antarctica as well. We had a crew from the History Channel come with us to Antarctica one time, and I was the voice for the geology.
Oh, we'll
of
have to find that. I'd be really interested in you've probably got a source.
There was a number of things that we did, and I've worked with PJ Conley a little bit. You know, he's got his scout company, and I mostly work behind the scenes with him just for different film projects.
Yeah, I've worked with him too, and that's fun, isn't it? Production stuff.
It's
a good, clean industry, and you go in, you get your stuff, you clean it up, and get out.
I got to go on the Wallapai Skywalk, courtesy of a movie company. I wasn't going to pay for it myself.
How did you take pictures and stuff?
Well, you can't bring a camera out there. At least you couldn't when I was there. You had to leave your camera in a locker, and then they have their person take pictures of you, and you can buy them for $30.
They're not missing a nickel, are they?
No. I wonder how it's doing during the pandemic, the whole Skywalk thing. I assume it's open again.
Well, I've gone by it a lot of times this year, and I always put some glass on it, and there's been people standing up out there. You can see them standing on it and stuff.
You know, I got to tell you how fun it is to see you at the ferry, because on my geology-themed river trips, with CRATE, Colorado River and Trail Expeditions, your outfit is always there on the same put-in
day. Yeah, it seems like it, huh?
Yeah, and, you know, I just got to say to you, Brian, I really appreciate your guiding style, and I've watched you.
I appreciate that.
And I see what your pace is on the trip, because once we leave the put-in, I never see you again until we're down there in the 190s. And, you know, I think you've got it down.
Well, you know, there's a certain window you can find where your group can go most of the trip, and the place is all yours. And that's a beautiful thing about Grand Canyon, is if you get a pulse on the traffic, you can either pull back, get in the middle, or get out ahead. There's those windows.
Well, you probably think that nobody knows you're doing that, but I'm watching you, and I know that
that's the nicest thing I've ever heard. Thank you.
It's true. I notice it.
Now, between the lectures and the books and the travel and stuff, what have we got coming up?
Well, actually, I got a really exciting project, and I'm working with Dr. Ryan Crow at the U.S. Geological Survey, and he and I are writing a geologic river guide to the Colorado River in Grand Canyon.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and it's going to be, well, people have already taken it down on the beta version, and
That would be fantastic.
There's about 9 miles of river that's covered on every open spread, And on half of the spread is a colored geologic map of those 9 miles. And then on the other half of the spread are the descriptions of what you see. You know, mile 80.3, look on the left, you'll see this. And
oh, that's fantastic.
It's really...
we've needed that.
It's done already, but it's in review, so we have to send it off to 2 formal reviewers. And unfortunately, because it's a government publication, there's going to be some delays. I was hoping to be out for the 22 river season, but it doesn't look like it's going to make it, unless there's a miracle. And I'm really excited about that. We have given it to a number of geologists to take down, and they have found it very helpful. Although, as you know, my style is not just to write to the scientists, but to also appeal to the interested non-specialists.
Yeah, no, and that's a real art that you have. You know, you can throw a bunch of terms and geology, and a lot of geologists do that, but to actually bring kind of a graspable, physical...
usually the big picture view
works. To that, yeah.
I like the big picture view, and I don't want to get lost in, you know, the name of this mineral or something like that, but how did the Grand Canyon form? Things like that. Talk about big picture things.
Yeah.
You know, talking about guiding styles, in all of my years of being a trail guide, I've only had to turn 3 people around after the first day. And I never told those people that they can't complete the trip. It's a really interesting way that you develop to talk to people and have them make the decision themselves that they're not going to be able to make it. And I can remember each of those 3 instances, the people could not keep up with the rest of the group, and it was obvious they were having knee problems or ankle problems or hip problems. But you never want to go to somebody and say you're kicked off the trip.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting thing to bring up.
It really is. And, you know, I know you feel this way too, but I have really enjoyed developing the guiding skill.
Yeah.
And the guiding skill really comes from a place where your client is the most important person on the trip, and you try to give them the best trip they can possibly have.
Oh, absolutely.
It might sound trite to the listener, but, you know, the most successful guides are going to be those that are invested in the success of their clientele.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, let's face it, the guiding profession has made it easier and easier and easier for people to be a client physically. And so you do find people that have lied on their questionnaire, and they're claiming to be in better shape than they are when you get them. But it took me a while to really realize, well, you got what you got there. And so maybe you split up the group and do the hard hike and the easy hike for the, you know, you've got multiple guides and stuff. And I find myself doing that more. And it really means a lot to those people, even if they're going on the short hike and the less elevation or whatever they're, you do adapt as a more seasoned guide.
I bet you do this too. Sometimes I will stay with the short group.
Yeah.
I don't always go with the long group because then those same people always have me and the people that stay behind never have me. And I'm happy to stay with the short group. And you're right. They appreciate that, and they notice it.
Well, and some of those hikes you've done so many times, it's kind of nice to be on the short hike. Let's face it. Did I say that?
My feelings exactly.
But back to this geology guide, it's going to be just another thing that exposes the guide's lies through the years. I remember when, you know, the Belknap guide was out there, and then the Larry Stevens came in with this. He really upped the game as far as his guide. And I kind of cursed him because I saw this, all these lies I had been, you know. The thing about the early guiding is you might not know everything. The main thing is don't hesitate with your answer.
Right.
Give them an answer. Yeah. Right. But as things have progressed and matured in this industry, the guiding thing, there's an amazing interpretive resource that we have now, and they have. And so it's really changed the game. And I think this geology guide is, I've been waiting for that.
Well, a lot of people
it will expose my lies, but I'm courageous enough to open the cover.
You're comfortable enough in having your lies exposed. You know, it was Richard Cordaroli who really pushed me, because I'd been hatching this idea for a number of years, and he kept pushing me. He kept saying, you know, Wayne, that would be a good thing. People are waiting for that, and I have to give him credit for pushing me into it. And then it turns out Ryan was going to do something, not what I had in mind, but something similar. And I just went to Ryan. I said, hey, let's coordinate on this. And he had the publishing reach for it, and I had the idea, and hopefully it'll be a great
fantastic
thing for the river community.
Yeah, I'll be standing. Are you going to have a signing?
Well, I hope so. I hope it happens one day soon. It's all ready. It just needs to be reviewed and finalized.
Yeah.
USGS is going to publish it. Maybe the Grand Canyon Conservancy will pick up once those copies sell out.
Uh-huh.
And it will, I understand, be free to download as a PDF online. All government things are free to download.
So. Right. They're public domain.
But so. The Conservancy could conceivably publish it and sell it, because it'll be in the public domain as a free PDF. So anybody could take it and publish it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No, and that's a noble thing is to make it that available, because everybody's looking for a dollar, right?
All of my books have done very well. You know, I have a Sedona geology book. I have the Ancient Landscapes of the Colorado Plateau.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Which really helps people sort of visualize what these rock layers are recording for us. And, you know, I just take my passion for geology and I try to put that into words.
And present it.
And people have told me, they said, man, I can hear you in there. And, you know, that's the greatest compliment you can give a writer.
No, and I couldn't agree with them more. The other thing is that kind of work can really inspire young people to get into geology.
Well, that's what Bill Breed did to me.
Yeah.
There's
mentors along the way.
He was so enthusiastic about geology. And
he was excited.
And
Carruthers is the same way.
Yes.
He's excited at every observation, you know. And so people really learn from him. But it fires them up and energizes people around you guys. So.
Well, maybe this is a good place to finish up. You know, let's hear it for the people that are following you and I and having their lives ruined by the Grand Canyon.
Yeah. If your life is marginal, well, come to the Grand Canyon. If it's really good, come to the Grand Canyon. It'll ruin you either way.
It'll detour you for sure.
But I have, in closing, Wayne, I have a serious question, and you're the primary target to ask. You've been all over the world, and you've seen the different human impacts everywhere you go, and the plastics in the ocean you're aware of and stuff. And I always am curious as to the optimism or pessimism of somebody with your observations. Now, what do we got? Or can you give us a short note as to, number one, are we doomed and is it too late? And number two, if it's not too late, maybe give us some ideas of what we've got to do to turn this thing around.
Well, this will probably be an answer that's unexpected, but being a geologist, I always take the long view.
Yeah.
And the long view is, it really doesn't matter whether we as the human species make it through the crap that we've developed, because the Earth has always come back from the disasters that have hit it, whether it be a meteorite impact or gases from lava flows that have caused the extinction of life. In a way, my geology has become a spiritual way to look at the world, because I know that after my mortal life is gone, everything else is going to continue. The volcano in Iceland or the Canary Islands is going to continue to erupt. Earthquakes will continue to happen. Everything's going to go on in the physical world. That doesn't mean that I am not interested in the problems that climate change are going to make for us in the near-term future here, in the plastics in the ocean. I bemoan all of that stuff. I do what I can to give money to organizations to try to halt that. And yet I keep in the back of my mind the long-term view that for the short period of time that we humans are in charge here on this planet, that time is going to pass. I don't know when it's going to pass, and I don't know how it's going to pass. I kind of think that when humanity gets to the end, it's not going to be pretty. But who knows? Maybe there'll be some hunters and gatherers who can make it through, and maybe the whole thing will start all over again. It seems that life is just this constant building towards something better, and then it crashes back on itself. And we certainly have had a huge impact in the numbers of people that are on the planet. I mean, it'll just make you the biggest pessimist in the world. And yet, a geologic view that it's all going to be all right once this human condition passes is something that makes me the eternal optimist.
Yeah, and that is true optimism. And, if you look at the demise of the dinosaurs, there was that one mammal that made it through the, 35,000? 65,000 years
65
ago.
Million
years. Million. 65 million years ago, the big rock hit, and probably another one's going to hit us.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be something, you know. And
I'm like you. I have great optimism about the universe.
Great.
But I worry about Earth's atmosphere, because look at the other planets. I look at it cosmically, and you kind of worry about Earth's atmosphere more than any single thing.
Well, you are right there. I mean, there could be something that we do that would really tweak Earth's atmosphere, and then you end up with a planet like Mars or Venus. God forbid it should be Venus. 800 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface.
That's hotter than that's hotter than July in the canyon, my God.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that is one thing that probably could make me a pessimist, but let's hope that doesn't happen. Hope this layer of atmosphere that we have can hang out.
I want you to keep having your big adventures. I don't want to tweak your optimism, and you do inspire, Wayne. You do inspire.
Thank you, Brian. So do you.
I certainly appreciate you being here, and let's eventually let's go on an adventure together.
That sounds great.
And for everybody that's been listening, this has been fantastic. We're going to have Wayne back. I just love it when you guys come back and listen to these things. You're with Wayne and Brian, and Wayne's big adventures have been fantastic, and you guys need to keep it right side up. Thanks for being here.
Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Dave Wegner and dedicated to all the scientists and river community who have worked to protect the Colorado River, Grand Canyon, and its environment. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures. Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.